October 13th, 1982, Morro Bay, California. The decomposed body of 43-year-old Diane Harlan is discovered in a stand of trees next to a beach, and she has been strangled to death with a leech belonging to one of her dogs. It turns out that Diane's eccentric 47-year-old husband, Hugh Harlan, had failed to report her missing for 11 days, and since the couple was known for having a turbulent relationship, Hugh becomes a potential suspect in his wife's murder. 4 years later, Hugh becomes a missing person after his abandoned pickup truck is discovered by the side of the highway. Investigators are unable to determine if Hugh's disappearance is connected to Diane's murder, but the crime is never solved, and no trace of Hugh is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering two separate cases involving couples that were featured on Unsolved Mysteries. The cases are not connected, but they have one major detail in common. One half of the couple was murdered, and their spouse subsequently went missing. I'm talking about the sagas of Hugh and Diane Harlan, as well as Larry Costine and Melissa Jo Sermons. The Harlans were a very eccentric married couple who lived in a small coastal town in California and were known for having heated arguments, but after taking her dogs out for a walk one night, Diane was strangled to death with one of their leashes. Since Hugh did not attempt to report his wife missing for 11 days, and there were inconsistencies in his story, the police suspected that he may have killed Diane, but did not have any evidence to prove it. However, the case would become a lot more complicated 4 years later, when Hugh inexplicably vanished without a trace. If Hugh was guilty of murder, it was theorized that he may have decided to run away or go off to some remote location to kill himself, but if he was innocent, what if the same person who murdered Diane killed Hugh as well before disposing of his body? The key difference between the Harlan case and our second featured story is that there was no 4-year age gap between the murder and the disappearance. Larry Costine was a rancher who was found shot to death inside his trailer, but even though he had last been seen in the company of his girlfriend, Melissa Jo Sermons, who went by the name Jo, she could not be found anywhere. At the outset, there was suspicion that Jo had murdered Larry before going on the run, but the authorities could not turn up any conclusive evidence to prove she was still alive. But during the past decade, investigators have come to believe that Jo was also a victim, and that another suspect was responsible for killing her and Larry before they disposed of her body. Regardless of what actually happened, both these cases continue to remain unsolved, so in this episode, I'll start off by discussing the Harlan case, before providing my theories and analysis, and then I'll move on to talking about Larry Costine and Melissa Jo Sermons. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by discussing Hugh and Diane Harlan. Our first story begins in 1982 in Morro Bay, California, a fishing village located next to the Pacific Ocean in San Luis Obispo County, which had a population of just over 9,000 people at that time. Our central figures are 47-year-old Hugh Harlan and his 43-year-old wife, Diane Harlan, who have been married for 10 years. The couple currently live rent-free at a ranch on Atascadero Road, and are also known for being very eccentric and colorful characters within the community. Sporting a large gray beard, Hugh is a self-employed fisherman who makes most of his income by selling the fish he catches around town. Fishing was the main industry in Morro Bay, and while work in that field was not always consistent during the 1970s and early 1980s, Hugh was fine with that, since he was known for working sporadically whenever he felt like it. He lived a very frugal lifestyle, in which he earned just enough money to survive, and always expressed his belief that one should only work for the sheer joy of working, if and when the spirit moved them. In spite of his quirky personality, Hugh got along reasonably well with the other residents in the community, and often volunteered to help them if they needed assistance. For instance, a local woman named Catherine Cordero claimed that Hugh once stopped by her business and saw them unloading fish, so he decided to spend the next several hours helping them out with the task and refused to take any money for his services. By contrast, Diane was known for being an antisocial individual who earned the nickname the Dog Lady because she seemed to prefer the company of her two dogs, Toto and Charity, to people. In fact, it was believed that Diane preferred her dogs to her own husband, as she and Hugh were known for constantly fighting with each other. Since Diane was unemployed, and the couple pretty much lived in poverty, Hugh often got angry at her for spending most of the income he brought home on her dogs, as well as friends and beggars who asked for money. When Diane was feeling particularly spiteful, she would sometimes serve Hugh a can of dog food for dinner, and it's even been rumored that she once secretly baked the dog food into a casserole she served him. Well, things would take a much darker turn on October the 13th, when a partially decomposed and partially nude woman's body was discovered under a stand of cypress trees which separated Morro Bay High School from a local beach. She had been strangled to death with a nylon dog leash which was wrapped around her neck, and a second dog leash, as well as a jade bracelet and a silver bracelet, was found at the scene. At the time, the police reported that the motive for the crime appeared to be sexual. Due to the level of decomposition, the victim could initially not be identified, so the Morro Bay Police Department issued a press release containing a description of the woman and her bracelets. Well, the owner of the ranch where the Harlins lived saw the press release and thought that the victim might be Diane, as he had not seen her in several days. Nearly 2 weeks earlier, Diane's two dogs, Toto and Charity, had returned to the ranch without her, and even though the owner advised Hugh to contact the police, Hugh declined to do so and seemed oddly unconcerned about the situation. After the owner showed Hugh the press release and urged him to contact the authorities, Hugh finally agreed to meet with the Morro Bay PD. When he saw the decomposed body and the two bracelets which had been found at the scene, he positively identified them as belonging to his wife. So it now seemed obvious that the woman was Diane, and she had been the victim of foul play. When Hugh was questioned by investigators, he claimed that the last time he saw Diane was on the evening of October the 2nd, 11 days before her body was discovered. According to Hugh, Diane had gone out for a walk with her two dogs, Toto and Charity, and even though the dogs eventually returned home, Diane did not. Indeed, the last confirmed sighting of Diane was from a witness who saw her walking two dogs at around 6:15 p.m. that night near Morro Bay High School. The area was less than half a mile away from her ranch, and Diane often liked to walk the dogs there. About an hour after Diane was last seen, witnesses recalled seeing Toto and Charity near the stand of trees where her body would be found, and Hugh said they returned home at around 11 p.m. Hugh claimed that it wasn't uncommon for his wife to run off and disappear for days at a time, so he thought she may have left with friends to go to Colorado and never bothered to report her missing to the police. Naturally, given the turbulent nature of Hugh and Diane's relationship, this made the police very suspicious. There were also some inconsistencies in Hugh's story, as he initially claimed that when Toto and Charity made their way home, they still had their leashes on. But when investigators revealed that Diane had been strangled to death and had a dog leash wrapped around her neck, and a second leash was found at the murder scene, Hugh changed his story and said that the dogs did return home without their leashes. When confronted about this discrepancy, Hugh asked for an attorney and told the police that he did not want to be questioned any further. After Hugh was released from custody, the San Luis Obispo Telegram Tribune ran an article about Diane's murder and phoned Hugh for comment. Hugh made an odd statement that the police were, quote-unquote, bringing disgrace to the community by investigating Diane's death as a homicide, as he believed that she had actually died of an aneurysm. According to Hugh, Diane was undergoing treatment for an aneurysm and sometimes forgot to take her medication, and after he consulted with an astrologist, they confirmed that this was Diane's exact cause of death. Hugh also mentioned that his wife had a special gift for predicting the future and may have foresaw her own death. She had previously owned a third dog named Ratzel, who passed away, and Hugh claimed that shortly before this took place, Diane told him she had a dream in which she learned that if something ever happened to Ratzel, she was going to die a short time later. Well, since Diane had been fatally strangled, Hugh's statements about her death not being a homicide were obviously not true, so he continued to remain on the police's radar as a potential suspect. At one point, detectives submitted a case against a suspect to the San Luis Obispo County District Attorney's Office, who felt there was not enough evidence to file charges. The suspect's attorney apparently told the police to, quote-unquote, charge him or leave him alone, but it was never publicly disclosed if this suspect was Hugh. Believe it or not, investigators once questioned convicted serial killer Henry Lee Lucas, who was notorious for making false confessions to a number of unsolved crimes during the mid-1980s, but they were able to establish that Lucas was elsewhere when Diane's murder took place. It's been reported that as the years went on, the Morro Bay PD eventually ruled out Hugh as a suspect, though they acknowledged that even if he wasn't personally responsible for killing Diane, he still may have known more about the crime than he was letting on, possibly because he was afraid of someone else. The crime continued to remain unsolved for 4 years, until an unexpected event took place on November 1, 1986. At around 9 a.m. that morning, Hugh, who was 51 years old by this point, stopped by a friend's house in order to borrow some tools, as he had been hired for a 2-day freelance construction job at a residence in San Simeon, located 27 miles northwest of Morro Bay. Hugh subsequently traveled to San Simeon in his blue 1967 Chevrolet utility bed pickup truck and completed part of the construction job before he left at 1:30 p.m. Hugh was last seen heading back towards Morro Bay, but this turned out to be the last time he was confirmed to be alive. 3 days later, one of Hugh's friends received a phone call from a mutual acquaintance who claimed they had seen Hugh's abandoned pickup truck parked on the side of Highway 1 near the town of Cambria, located about 9 miles southeast of San Simeon. Two of Hugh's friends decided to visit the scene, and sure enough, Hugh's truck was parked there facing north, and the doors were locked and the hood was up. A number of Hugh's personal possessions were still inside, including his backpack, sleeping bag, lunch, and the tools he had borrowed from his friend. Hugh's glasses, as well as some tins containing tobacco and ragweed pot he liked to smoke, were on the dashboard. Oddly, the truck's keys were found on the ground next to a wooded area a few feet away, and after the authorities were summoned to the scene, they discovered that the truck's fuel line had been removed. However, there was no sign of Hugh anywhere, and an extensive search of the area failed to turn up any trace of him. There were a number of different theories pushed forward about Hugh's disappearance. One theory was that Hugh pulled over because he was experiencing problems with the fuel line, so he removed it from the truck and was in the midst of walking to a service station when something happened to him. But of course, there was a lot of speculation that the situation was somehow connected to Diane's murder. Due to the suspicion that surrounded him, it was theorized that Hugh may have staged his disappearance and decided to vanish on his own accord, as he was a survivalist who knew how to live off the land and could remain off the grid for long periods of time. Alternatively, if Hugh had killed Diane, perhaps he finally became so overwhelmed with guilt that he decided to take off into a remote area and kill himself. However, Hugh's friends did not believe he would have willingly abandoned his truck without telling anyone, so they wondered if he might have been harmed by the same individual who murdered Diane. Regardless, there was no conclusive evidence to indicate what happened to Hugh, and even though the case was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in April of 1994, it failed to bring about any new leads, which led the investigation any closer to a resolution. So after 4 decades, there are still no definitive answers about Diane Harlan's murder or why Hugh Harlan disappeared. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. Thank you. So this is definitely a very bizarre case, and it's a shame that other than the Unsolved Mystery segment, there really isn't all that much information out there about it, as I sense that we're missing some pieces of the puzzle here. Even though you can find individual photos out there of Hugh and Diane, the only photo you'll find of the couple together is this creepy and ominous black and white one, which looks like it could have been taken back in the 1800s. But I suppose that's only appropriate, given what unique and colorful characters these two people were. I know it's become a cliche in true crime circles to describe victims as the type of person who would light up a room, but while I mean no disrespect to Diane Harlan, I don't think anyone would use that phrase to describe her. Everyone who knew her said that she seemed like someone who preferred the company of dogs to people and was not overly friendly or outgoing, and since her marriage to Hugh did not seem like an overly happy one, you can see why investigators thought he was capable of killing her. However, the Unsolved Mystery segment contained interviews with some of Hugh's former friends who believed he was innocent and did not think he would have crossed the line and committed murder. I previously shared a story about how Hugh once spent several hours helping a business owner named Catherine Cordero unload fish and refused to accept any payment for his troubles, and Cordero was one of his defenders on the show. She stated, quote, "He may have been weird at times, but he wasn't a weirdo," end quote. Cordero also recounted a story where she flat out asked Hugh point blank if he had killed Diane, stating, quote, "He said he didn't do it. I knew when he answered that question, he was telling the truth," end quote. Well, I wouldn't say that's definitive proof that Hugh was innocent, as there are definitely a number of things which paint Hugh in a suspicious light. But then again, how many of these things are the result of Hugh's eccentric personality rather than genuine signs of guilt? An alternate possibility is that Hugh may not have been directly responsible for Diane's murder, but acted so strangely about the situation because he was secretly glad to be rid of her. So let's go over the details which do not paint Hugh in a positive light. He waited 11 days to report Diane missing, and even though he claimed that it was typical behavior for her to take off for long periods of time, the fact that she went out for a walk with the dogs and they returned home without her should have been a major red flag. After all, it sounds like Diane cared more about her dogs than anything, so I think that at the very least, she would have ensured they were taken care of before she went anywhere. Hugh originally claimed that the dogs came back with their leashes still on, but then changed his story when police told him his wife had been strangled with a leash. And then he gave that bizarre newspaper interview where he tried to claim that Diane died of an aneurysm and her death was not a homicide, which is definitely not how you would expect a grieving husband to act if he was seeking justice for his murdered wife. One of the biggest issues is that we don't know who else would have had a motive to kill Diane other than Hugh. Yes, since Diane was supposedly murdered while she was taking her dogs for a walk, she could have crossed paths with someone else who harmed her, but a woman with two dogs at her side would not seem like an ideal target for a random attacker. And how many attackers would go to the trouble of removing the dog's leash and using it to strangle Diane? How could they be certain the dogs would not attack them for harming her? One of the biggest issues in the Harlans' marriage is that Diane seemed to be a lot more fond of Totu and Charity than her own husband, and even went so far as to serve him dog food if he complained about her spending too much money on the dogs. So using a leash to strangle Diane could definitely have been some sort of symbolic gesture on Hugh's part. One detail which might point away from Hugh is that Diane was found partially nude, and investigators believe she might have been sexually assaulted, though I get the impression that her body was too decomposed to determine that for certain. That isn't to say that murderers do not sexually assault their own spouses, but we do have independent eyewitnesses who saw Diane walking her dogs alone near the spot where her body was found, so it's not impossible that she could have crossed paths with someone who wanted to assault her. Now, another detail which might point away from Hugh and doesn't get mentioned too much is that he was missing a thumb and forefinger on his left hand. Strangulation is an act of violence which usually requires both hands, and if Hugh only had three fingers on one of his hands, this makes me question whether he would have been able to get a strong enough grip on the leash in order to exact the necessary force required to fatally strangle Diane. It's been reported that at one point, the police tried to submit a case against a suspect to the district attorney's office, but they felt the evidence was insufficient to file charges. While the suspect was never publicly named, I do think there's a good chance that it was Hugh, but it's also never been specified when exactly the case was submitted during the 4-year gap between when Diane was murdered and Hugh disappeared. The Unsolved Mystery segment claimed that Hugh was eventually ruled out as a suspect, but I'm not sure if investigators made this decision because they found definitive proof that Hugh could not have done this. But an intriguing theory I've seen pushed forward is that police intentionally lied about Hugh being ruled out as a suspect because if he was still alive somewhere and felt there was no longer a risk of him being charged with murder, he might decide to resurface. However, the alternate scenario that investigators push forward is that Hugh might not have been directly responsible for Diane's death, but still knew more than he was letting on. I suppose Hugh could have orchestrated a murder-for-hire plot, but as someone who pretty much lived in poverty and often had his meager income squandered by his wife, I don't think Hugh would have had much in the way of money to pay someone to kill Diane. Perhaps Hugh did have an inkling of who else might have murdered Diane, but either due to fear, or because he flat-out didn't care about seeing someone prosecuted for the crime, he elected to remain silent about his suspicions. Again, that's not how most husbands would react to the murder of their wife, but Hugh was just not your typical husband. So this leads us to the question of whether Hugh's subsequent disappearance had any connection to Diane's case. It would be one thing if the investigation was closing in on Hugh, and the authorities were on the verge of arresting him, but I see no indication that this was the case. If Hugh wanted to disappear voluntarily, it's not implausible that he could have stayed off the grid for a long period of time, as he was a survivalist who knew how to eke out a living with very little money. The alternative explanation is that if Hugh did kill Diane, he became so overwhelmed with guilt that he walked off into some remote wooded area in order to kill himself, and his body simply hasn't been found. But if either of those scenarios are true, then why would Hugh suddenly decide to do this 4 years after the death of his wife? Well, I don't think the evidence really supports a voluntary disappearance, because Hugh left a number of personal items behind in his pickup truck, such as his glasses, sleeping bag, and some tobacco and ragweed pot that he liked to smoke. And since Hugh was known for having a generous nature, his friends believed that if he no longer wanted his truck, he would have left it with someone before he disappeared, or at the very least, returned the tools he had borrowed from his friend earlier that day. Another detail which would seem to go against both the voluntary disappearance and suicide theories is that Hugh had spent a good portion of the day working on a construction job in San Simeon. I mean, if Hugh was feeling suicidal, maybe he felt that he at least wanted to complete this job before he ended his own life, but the problem is that this was described as a 2-day construction job, and Hugh had only completed 1 day of work. And I'm assuming that Hugh wouldn't get paid until the entire job was completed, meaning that he would not have this extra money on him if he was planning to disappear. When Hugh's truck was found, the fuel line had been removed, so an additional theory was that if Hugh was having issues with it, he could have pulled over and attempted to take the fuel line to the nearest service station. Perhaps he attempted to hitch a ride with someone who wound up killing him and disposing of his body. However, the big hole in that theory is that Hugh's keys were found on the ground several feet away from the truck, so why would he have tossed them there if he was planning to walk elsewhere for assistance? The keys are actually the biggest piece of evidence which might point to a voluntary disappearance or a suicide, but this also doesn't account for why the fuel line would be missing. Barring the possibility that Hugh crossed paths with a random motorist who did him harm, I just don't know who else would have had a motive to kill him. If he was killed by the same person who murdered Diane, why was there a 4-year gap? Even if Hugh did have some knowledge of who actually murdered his wife, he hadn't said anything during those 4 years, and as far as I can tell, there was nothing to indicate he was going to contact the authorities anytime soon. Could this have been some sort of vigilante revenge scheme by someone who believed Hugh murdered Diane and wanted to take care of him? If so, who else would have cared about Diane that much to do this? Furthermore, why would Hugh come to harm at this particular location on the highway, which was halfway between San Simeon and Morro Bay? Did someone sabotage Hugh's fuel line ahead of time and then follow him until he was forced to pull his truck over? I don't know if I should read anything into this, but it also struck me as odd that the truck was described as facing north by the side of the road, even though Hugh should have been driving south if he was heading back to Morro Bay. I guess the issue with figuring out what happened here is that we know so little about the Harlins' personal lives, and if they had other enemies who would have had a motive to kill Hugh, Diane, or both of them. This is one case where, with the information we do have, there really isn't one concrete theory which makes complete sense. Overall, I would say that Hugh murdering Diane and then abandoning his truck and walking off somewhere to either start over or end his own life is the theory which seems like the most logical, but there are still some holes in it. But maybe the flaw here is that we're trying to apply standard logic towards the actions of a unique individual like Hugh Harlan, so who knows what was going on inside his head at that time. Given the amount of time that has passed, I'm not sure if this case is still being actively investigated, but I'd certainly love to know the truth about what happened. So if you have any information on the unsolved murder of Diane Harlan and the subsequent disappearance of Hugh Harlan, please contact the Morro Bay Police Department at 805-772-6225. That's 805-772-6225. So now let's move on to our next case. Our second story begins in Polk County, Florida in 1992. Our central figures are 31-year-old Elwin Lawrence Costine Jr., who goes by the name Larry, and his 26-year-old girlfriend, Melissa Jo Sermons, who goes by the name Joe. Larry is a cowboy who developed an interest in riding horses when he was only 2 years old, and he now works with horses and cattle at a ranch on Moore Road, just outside of Lakeland. Larry also resides in a mobile home on the property, as the Costines are considered to be a pioneer family in Polk County, and at the turn of the century, Larry's great-great-grandfather homesteaded this particular stretch of land, and it has been passed down through several generations. Since Larry's father passed away 2 years earlier, he has a particularly close relationship with his paternal uncle, Erlo Costine, whom he almost considers to be a second father. Erlo works as the barn manager for the Cattlemen's Livestock Auction Market, and since Joe was one of Erlo's employees there, she wound up becoming acquainted with Larry, and they started dating. Larry has already gone through one previous marriage, but since he started seeing Joe before his divorce with his ex-wife Donna was finalized, they kept their relationship a secret, and not even Erlo knew about it. On Saturday, May the 2nd, Larry and Joe traveled to Dade City so that Larry could participate in the weekly rodeo, and he and his partner wound up winning the team roping competition and splitting the $350 prize. Since the rodeo started at 10 p.m. and ran very late, Larry and Joe would go out for breakfast with a friend at around 2 a.m. on May the 3rd. They then proceeded to drive back to Lakeland, where Larry dropped off his friend at 4 a.m. Larry and Joe presumably decided to spend the rest of the night at Larry's mobile home, which was about a 15-minute drive away, but sometime after they arrived there, an horrific crime would occur. On the evening of May the 3rd, Erlo received a phone call from Joe's mother, June Freeman, who told him that Joe had still not returned home, and this marked the first time that Erlo learned that they were involved in a relationship. Erlo attempted to phone Larry, but there was no answer, and when Joe failed to show up for work at the auction market on the morning of Monday, May the 4th, Erlo decided to pay a visit to Larry's trailer. When Erlo arrived, Larry's truck was still parked out front, and even though Erlo could hear a radio playing inside the trailer, there was no answer to repeated knocks at the front door. Erlo became concerned enough that he contacted his wife and asked her to call the Polk County Sheriff's Office, and a deputy would soon meet Erlo outside the mobile home. When they opened the front door, they immediately noticed a terrible smell, which made Erlo suspect that his nephew might be dead. Sure enough, after they went inside, they discovered Larry's nude body lying on the bedroom floor. He had been shot in the head and the back a total of 4 times. There was no sign of any struggle or forced entry, and since a search of Larry's wallet turned up $306 in cash, robbery did not appear to be the motive for the crime. However, Erlo did notice that a .357 caliber revolver that Larry owned appeared to be missing, and it would later turn out that he was most likely shot with the same weapon. There was no sign of Joe anywhere, and since she had still not returned home or contacted her family, they officially filed a missing persons report. A search of the area failed to turn up any trace of Joe, leading to fear that she may have become the victim of foul play. Right from the outset, Joe's family had suspicions about her ex-boyfriend, Danny Cerezo. Danny worked as a state agricultural inspector and was acquainted with Erlo, since he often paid visits to the cattleman's livestock auction market. Joe and Danny had lived together for about 14 months, but only weeks before she disappeared, Joe ended their relationship and moved out. Danny was known for being jealous and possessive and would confront any man he saw speaking to Joe, and by all accounts, he did not take the breakup well. In fact, he attempted to remain friends with Joe's family and would often ask them about her relationships with other men. According to June Freeman, after Joe moved out, Danny started stalking her and following her around and phoned her up constantly. There was even one incident where Joe's family caught him sneaking around underneath their kitchen window to eavesdrop on their conversations. In addition, prior to becoming involved with Joe, Danny had been married and went through some serious issues with his ex-wife, Dreema, who had filed for divorce from him 3 years earlier. Dreema also filed an injunction for protection against Danny, as he accused him of being abusive and alleged that there was one incident where Danny ran off the road to demand sex. After the divorce was finalized and both sides reached a settlement, Dreema agreed to drop the injunction against Danny. Even though Joe had been keeping her relationship with Larry a secret, on the evening of May the 2nd, several hours before she went missing, Joe was overheard having a phone conversation with Danny in which she told him that she did not want to see him anymore because she was now involved with Larry. The lead investigator for the Polk County Sheriff's Office was Detective Bob Orr, who proceeded to interview Danny. Orr claimed that Danny provided him with an alibi for the early morning hours of May the 3rd, which placed him at another location during the time period Larry's murder was believed to have taken place. Orr seemed to think that Danny's alibi was credible, so he did not believe Danny had any involvement in the crime and ruled him out as a suspect. So Detective Orr started exploring the possibility that after arriving back at the mobile home together, Larry and Joe got into a heated argument, which led to her grabbing Larry's gun and fatally shooting him before she fled the scene. Since Larry was described as being someone who could hold his own and take care of himself during a confrontation, Orr believed that Joe was the only person who could have gotten close enough to Larry to shoot him without a struggle. Of course, Joe and Larry's family members did not believe this theory at all, as they found it more plausible that both victims were killed by a third party who abducted Joe from the scene and killed her and disposed of her body at another location. However, one person who was inclined to believe that Joe was the perpetrator was Larry's ex-wife Donna, as she claimed that Larry was capable of getting people extremely angry and causing them to lose their temper. So she wondered if Larry might have driven Joe to the breaking point and prompted her to shoot him. Following Joe's disappearance, there were numerous reported sightings of her in states like Florida, Texas, and Kansas. Since Joe was licensed to operate a tractor-trailer, two witnesses were certain that they had seen her hauling livestock behind the wheel of a big rig. Joe's mother, June, also worked as a truck driver, so she would be accused of helping Joe elude the authorities by hiding her in a series of long-distance freight hauls by other truckers. June completely denied these allegations and believed that the police became suspicious because she never cried or got overly emotional in front of them, stating, quote, "I didn't do it. I wasn't raised that way. But as soon as they left, I went inside and bawled like a baby," end quote. The case would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in November of 1993. Detective Orr was interviewed during the segment, and even though Joe had been missing for a year and a half at that point, he personally believed that the eyewitness sightings of her were credible and continued to suspect that she was responsible for Larry's murder and hiding out somewhere as a wanted fugitive. Sadly, Larry's mother, Coraline Kostein, passed away in February of 2013 at the age of 84 without receiving answers about what happened to her son. However, 5 months later, in July of that year, there would be a surprising development as the Polk County Sheriff's Office revealed that they were now looking at the case in an entirely different light. They officially announced that they now believe that both Larry and Joe had been the victims of foul play, and Danny Cerezo was the prime suspect. Polk County Sheriff spokesman Donna Wood told the public, quote, "We need additional information to help put all the pieces of the puzzle together, and it is an investigation we continue to work," end quote. Now, investigators have never publicly confirmed why exactly they changed their mind about Danny after all these years, but some additional information about this can be found in a series of message board posts, and I'll be discussing that in more detail later on. In August of 2014, the Polk County Attorney's Office subpoenaed Danny and a number of other witnesses to testify in front of a grand jury. The Sheriff's Office revealed that there had been new developments in the investigation, but could not share any specific details, only that they were also looking at someone else close to Danny who may have been involved. On August the 28th, after giving his testimony to the grand jury, Danny wound up being indicted for perjury after being accused of lying under oath. He would be held in the Polk County Jail before he was released on a $5,000 bond a few weeks later. Since Danny was 66 years old at the time and had a state job at the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, a circuit judge ordered a freeze on his retirement fund to prevent him from potentially retiring and accessing a large sum of money in order to flee the area. But frustratingly, I have been unable to find any further follow-up to this. I have no idea how Danny's perjury case turned out and if he ever went on trial or went to prison for the crime. All I know for certain is that Danny has not been indicted on any murder charges, and Joe has never been found, and she is technically still a missing person. At the very least, Joe is no longer considered to be a suspect in Larry's murder, but for the moment, the investigation has reached a standstill, and both crimes continue to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So Unsolved Mysteries covered a few cases where one half of a couple was found murdered and the other half went missing at the same time, so there was ambiguity about whether the missing spouse was the killer or an additional victim. One case which was very similar to this one, and that I also covered on episode number 39 of The Trail Went Cold, was the murder of Latricia White, who was found shot to death in her home in Texas in December of 1993. Latricia's live-in boyfriend, Lee Dobb Walkerhagen, was also missing from the scene, along with Chance Walkerhagen, Dub's 9-year-old son from a previous marriage, who had been visiting for the Christmas holidays. Since Dub and Latricia were known for having a volatile relationship and got into a heated argument a few days before the crime, the authorities were inclined to believe that Dub committed the murder and subsequently went on the run with Chance, so a warrant was issued for his arrest. But as time went on, neither Dub or Chance ever surfaced, and 2 decades later, the authorities announced that they had uncovered new evidence to make them believe that Latricia was actually murdered by a third party, who also killed Dub and Chance before disposing of their bodies. It's been alleged that some serious mistakes were made during the early stages of the investigation, which gave the authorities the false impression that Dub was the perpetrator, and it sounds like some even more egregious mistakes were made in this particular case. Much like with Dub Walkerhagen, the investigators here were inclined to believe that Melissa Jo Sermons was responsible for shooting Larry Kostein before she went on the run. But she never resurfaced, so once again, 2 decades after the fact, the authorities announced that they now believe that Larry had been murdered by a third party who also abducted and murdered Jo before disposing of her body. Sadly, it sounds like all these years of looking in the wrong direction seriously hampered the investigations, which is why both cases are still unsolved to this day, and the missing victims have never been found. Now, I can understand the logic of considering Dub Walkerhagen to be a potential suspect, since he was known for having a volatile temper and being verbally abusive, though he had never actually crossed the line into physical violence. While she has since changed her mind about this, Dub's ex-wife initially believed that he was capable of shooting Latricia, though she didn't think he ever would have harmed their son. However, I've seen nothing to indicate that Melissa Jo Sermons had any known history of violence or serious issues in her relationship with Larry. In fact, Joe and Larry had only been dating for a short time, so how could things have escalated to the point where she decided to shoot him 4 times and run away? It seems like one person who thought Joe would have been capable of this was Larry's ex-wife Donna, not because she believed Joe was a violent person, but because she thought Larry was the type of individual who could push someone's buttons and drive them to the point where they would snap and shoot him. But in retrospect, it seems like Donna was allowing her own personal experiences with Larry to cloud her judgment. So I suppose there's no point continuing to debate whether Joe was a killer or a victim, because the authorities have pretty much answered that question. Even back when I first watched the Unsolved Mysteries segment during the 1990s, I had serious doubts that Joe was the perpetrator. The segment did mention that Joe had an ex-boyfriend who did not take their breakup well and had been stalking her, though they did not reveal his identity, and Danny Cerezo would not be named publicly until 2013. The idea of the ex-boyfriend committing the crime seemed to make a lot more sense than Joe being the killer, but Detective Bob Orr stated on camera that this man had an alibi and was not considered to be a suspect. It now appears that this alibi was not as solid as Detective Orr thought, so what in the hell went wrong here? Well, back in 2010, everyone was taken by surprise when this passage suddenly appeared on the Unsolved Mysteries wiki page about this case. Quote, updated. Melissa Jo Sermons and Larry Kostein were killed by Joe and Danny Cerezo of DeLand, Florida. Danny Cerezo was Melissa's ex-boyfriend. According to Joe Cerezo, Melissa is buried somewhere in the Green Swamp of Central Florida. Neither of the men were charged in the crime due to the uncooperation of the Polk County State Attorney's Office. Joe Cerezo died in November of 2008, but before his death, he confessed to the crime, adding it was his brother Danny who shot the first shot. Danny Cerezo suffers from throat cancer, but still goes about his daily business as a forest ranger for the Florida Parks Department. End quote. Someone started a thread about this case on the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, which I'm always referencing, and it wasn't long before a poster under the username The Black Parrot started leaving comments in which they confirmed that they were the person who wrote that text at the Unsolved Mysteries wiki. Now, obviously, since these are internet message board posts, I can't 100% vouch for the accuracy of the information that The Black Parrot shared, but it's worth noting that these comments were made back in 2010, and Danny Cerezo did not get named as a suspect until 2013. A lot of the information The Black Parrot shared was not public knowledge at the time, but it wound up checking out years later, and she even provided some documentation to support her claims. So long story short, The Black Parrot said that she was the wife of a man who served time in prison with Danny's brother, Joe Cerezo, and had been his cellmate. Also, for the purpose of clarity, and to avoid confusing him with Joe Sermons, I'm now going to be referring to Joe Cerezo as Joseph. Joseph had an extensive criminal history and spent most of his life in and out of prison, and he and Danny were reportedly involved in cocaine trafficking. While serving time in prison with the Black Parrot's husband, Joseph allegedly made a full confession to assisting his brother with Larry and Joe's murders. The story goes that after they attended the rodeo, Larry and Joe crossed paths with the Cerezo brothers at a bar, who later decided to pay a visit to Larry's mobile home. After Danny and Joseph went inside and found Larry and Joe in bed together, Danny grabbed Larry's gun from the bedside stand and fatally shot him. The two brothers then proceeded to abduct Joe from the trailer and murdered her at another location before dumping her body somewhere in the Green Swamp. After hearing Joseph's confession, his cellmate came forward and shared this information with the authorities in 2007, but it seems like they were reluctant to do anything about it at the time, and Joseph passed away 1 year later. So if you're wondering about Danny's so-called alibi, the Black Parrot said it was provided by his own mother, and given the history of criminal activity in that family, it's certainly not implausible that their mother could have lied to protect them. During our comments, the Black Parrot also mentioned some other mistakes from the original investigation, which would be pretty jaw-dropping if true. For instance, some unidentified shoe prints were found at the crime scene, and when Joseph was questioned about this, he simply said, quote, "That's not my shoe size," and investigators just took him at his word without actually checking his shoes. There were also tire track impressions found outside Larry's trailer, which did not match Joseph's truck, and were used as another reason to rule out the Cerezos as suspects. But the problem is that Joseph and Danny supposedly borrowed their nephew's car when they committed the crime, and this vehicle was never checked. Apparently, when Joseph confessed to his cellmate, he laughed at just how easy it had been for him to get away with this crime. Anyway, the Black Parrot hasn't left any posts on the message board since 2013, and she also mentioned having been diagnosed with breast cancer and not knowing how much longer she'll be around, so I hope she is still alive today. But if all the information she shared is true, and the whole situation is pretty infuriating, as it sounds like the original investigators, particularly Detective Bob Orr, blew what should have been a very solvable case in a huge way. Looking at the big picture, this appears to be one of the least mysterious cold cases ever featured on The Trail Went Cold, and a pretty major travesty. It's bad enough that Larry and Joe's loved ones have been denied justice for 3 decades, but I find it particularly egregious that Joe's family also had to live with the grief of her being falsely accused of being a murderer. Hell, they even faced ridiculous allegations that they were helping Joe hide from the authorities. As a disclaimer, I should confirm that even though Danny Cerezo has been publicly named as a suspect, Joseph Cerezo has not, though investigators did make one statement that they were looking at someone close to Danny, and it's reasonable to assume they were referring to his brother. Since Joseph was deceased at that point, I guess the authorities were reluctant to name him without conclusive proof, but he was a career criminal, so it's not implausible to think that he may have participated in this crime. Larry was described as being someone who could take care of himself during a fight, but during his confession, Joseph apparently said that he held a gun over Larry and Joe. This would explain why there was no sign of any struggle, and it would have given Danny the opportunity to grab Larry's gun from the nightstand and shoot him. The murder weapon has never been found, but I'm sure the Cerezos felt they would have an easier time getting away with it if they used the victim's own gun rather than a firearm that could be traced back to them. It's been reported that Danny had been obsessively stalking Joe following their breakup, and I think it's too much of a coincidence that this crime took place only hours after Joe was overheard telling Danny on the phone that she was now dating Larry. Danny could have formulated a plan for him and his brother to follow Larry and Joe to the trailer, and I'm sure finding them in bed together would have sent him into a violent rage. It's possible that Danny had not yet decided what he wanted to do with Joe, which is why she was abducted from the trailer rather than being killed there. But if Danny had always intended on killing Joe and disposing of her body in hopes of framing her for Larry's murder, then his strategy actually worked out a lot better for him than he ever could have anticipated. So the obvious question is, why did this investigation just seem to ground to a dead halt after Danny was indicted for perjury? It's been 9 years since Danny was released on bail for the charge, and we haven't heard a thing since then. Obviously, since the whole situation came about after a grand jury proceeding, specific details were not released publicly, but they must have had pretty strong evidence that Danny was lying during his testimony if they decided to indict him for perjury. I know that the Black Parrot mentioned in her posts that Danny was suffering from throat cancer, so I guess this could have prevented the authorities from moving forward with his prosecution. I have been unable to find any obituaries for Danny or proof to indicate that he has since passed away, but if he is still alive, he would currently be 74 years old, and the clock is ticking in order to file charges against him. It's possible that the details of Danny's perjury case have been kept from the public, but what we do know for certain is that he has never been charged with murder. The authorities did mention that they believed that they had physical evidence tying Danny to the murders, but they obviously did not feel it was strong enough to charge him and secure a conviction. The lack of follow-up media coverage about this situation is pretty frustrating. Even though the Unsolved Mysteries episodes on the official FilmRise channel generally include text updates about recent developments, there is nothing like that on the segment about this case. There is no mention at all about Danny Cerezo, so people watching this segment for the first time might be left with a mistaken impression that Melissa Jo Sermons is still a viable suspect in Larry's murder. If all these allegations about Danny and Joseph being the perpetrators are true, then Danny might be the last surviving individual who could lead the authorities to Joe's remains. I really don't know what the current status of this investigation is, but perhaps the last piece of the puzzle they need to solve this is for the right person to come forward with information. So if you happen to have any information about the murder of Larry Costine and the disappearance of Melissa Jo Sermons, please contact the Polk County Sheriff's Office at 863-533-0344. That's 863-533-0344. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, we released a bonus episode about a fraud case from Unsolved Mysteries involving a man named Woody Kelly, who embezzled millions of dollars from his clients before he vanished without a trace and has not been seen for nearly 38 years. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1992 murder of Heather Uffelman by an individual known only as Tom Johnson. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Fran K., Gene L., and Kimberly T. Thank you so much for your support. I also just wanted to mention that The Trail Went Cold will be in attendance at two separate CrimeCon events that are taking place in 2023. The first one is CrimeCon UK, which is returning to London and will be held at the Tower Bridge Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa on June the 10th and 11th. And 2 months after that, I'll be attending the regular CrimeCon event, which will be held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code which can be used to get a special 10% discount on tickets, and this time around, the same code is valid for both events. So in order to purchase tickets and get a 10% discount, you can either visit crimecon.co.uk or crimecon.com and use the special promo code COLE23. That's COLE23. Hope to see you there. Oh, and I also want to announce that The Trail Went Cold is signed up for this year's True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place from August the 25th to the 27th at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel in Austin, Texas. For more information, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm